Part 3. Dust. From House Ra. Pulvis et umbra sumus. We are but dust and shadow. Chapter 40. Lysander, the Bleeding Place. Cassius is lost in thought. Staring up at a dragon carved into the stone of the antechamber, its snout is long, its greedy maw open and lined with uneven teeth. The bold knight that faced down the Ra family has departed, leaving behind the tormented, reflective soul I know. The wounds where the grizzly pierced his face are swollen and red, but he's shaved his beard and looks younger than he has in years. Only his eyes are old. "What are you thinking?" I ask. He does not seem to hear me. The distant voices from 100 throats whisper from behind 2 black doors down a set of stone stairs just beneath the dragon's gaze. Our grey guards give us space, allowing us to speak. "Cassius?"
"It was a flower," he says quietly.
"A flower?" I realise he is far from here. "A white edelweiss. That was the last thing Father gave me before he died." He pauses, eyes still fixed on the dragon. He rarely speaks of his family. "It was a proud day," he says slowly. He spares a look at the guards. "You were too young then. Mother kept you at Eagle Rest. But the rest of us were in Aegea, on the citadel steps, where Augustus used to give the perennial address. The sovereign summoned us there for a council of war. Augustus's ships were 2 days from Deimos. The sun was high in the sky. You could feel the energy of a storm in the air. Wind had already come, rain was following. I remember smelling the flowering Judas trees from the steps, and for once our silver eagle flew from the flagpoles of the citadel, where all my life I'd only seen lions. It was to be the end of a corrupt Mars and the beginning of our era. We had the numbers, we had the right, and once we defeated Augustus, we would have Mars, something Father never coveted, so I knew he would treat her well. But I was ashamed. After I lost the deal to Darrow, my father told me he was disappointed. Not that I had lost. He was ashamed at my selfishness," he grimaces. "My petty pride. The carvers mended me, and I put myself to one purpose. Redemption in his eyes. I begged the sovereign to let me lead the legions sent to trap Augustus at the dockyards of Ganymede after Pliny gave us the intel. She sent Barker along to ensure I did not fail. I didn't. I returned to Aegea, dragging Augustus behind us in chains. I found redemption in her eyes, but I didn't have Father's till we stood on those steps and he saw how I'd changed. He was to meet the Augustans in orbit with our cousins and sisters. I was given the rest of our family forces to defend Aegea. You've never known pride like it, Castor. The shining faces, the laughter, the hair and pennants kicking in the wind as 2 full generations of Bellona strolled out from the summit in armour under the sun. He turned to me at the foot of the stairs and told me he loved me. He'd done it 1,000 times before, but it was different. 'The boy has fled,' he said. 'In his place I see a man.' It was the first time I felt I deserved his love, to be his son. I realised how lucky I was, how blessed I was to have a father like him. In a world of terrible men, he was patient, kind, noble in the way the stories told us to be as boys. I glanced to see if the guards are listening. Their faces from the bridge of the nose down are covered with duroplastic breathing units. The flinty eyes that peer out from beneath the grey hoods give nothing away. He took an edelweiss from a pouch in his armour and pressed it into my hands and told me to remember home, to remember the Olympus Mons, to remember why we fight, not for family or for pride, but for life. The flower had grown near his favourite bench on a ridgeline there, just beyond the outbuildings of the rest. He'd climb to that ridgeline every day before the sun set to find peace from us children, from work, he smiles, from mother. Sometimes, if I was very lucky and quiet, he would let me walk with him, and we'd talk or just sit and watch the eagles visit their nests in the crags. It was the only time I remember being truly happy, not craving something more. Julian was Mother's favourite, but Father didn't play that game. He smiles. I know he was not happy with the venal creature I became in the years before the Institute, or the bitter one thereafter, but there on the steps, when he pressed the flower into my hands, I knew I'd finally become the man he always hoped I would be. There are tears in his eyes. "What happened to the flower?" I asked gently, not wanting to break the spell. "I lost it in the mud," he looks back to me in shame. "I didn't think it would be the last time I would ever see him."
He's quiet, wrestling with something larger than the fear of the coming duel. All of them are dead, all those shining faces dimmed, their laughter, just silence. I want to see them again. He almost says my name before catching himself. He looks to the door. Hear them, feel father's hands on my head. But I won't, not even when I die. The void is all that will greet me. You won't die today, Cassius. You can beat him, I say, knowing that even if he wins, our lives are likely forfeit. You are the morning knight. You are still that good man as our father saw, and you are not meant to be the last Bellona. My brother. He smiles and rests a hand on my shoulder. Sometimes I forget how young you are. I'm not afraid that I won't beat him. He looks up at the dragon, past her teeth and into the hungry darkness of her throat. I'm afraid because this world is all that is. Carnus was right. He smiles at a private joke. But who knows, perhaps the darkness will be kinder than the light. He looks down at the black doors and listens to the voices beyond them. No matter what fate waits beyond those doors, do not acquiesce. If they have their evidence, they have their war. It is our duty, even if it is our last, to prevent that war, to protect the people. It is not our republic to protect, I say. That's Octavia speaking, not you. Of course it is ours to protect. Why? It's a broken place that betrayed us. The people you want to save are being ground into the dirt. Dido is right, the Reaper has failed. I pause. Choices were made, I say slowly, choosing my words with care so he does not feel assaulted. Though I may not agree, I understand why you made them. The Sovereign let the Jackal massacre our family. She was a tyrant, I know that. The society was corrupt. But look what's replaced it. The people on that ship. I see them every night, and I think what I could have done better. But they didn't die because I chose to help Gold first. They died because of Darrow. I hesitate. You opened Pandora's box. Now you've spent those years trying to justify the choices you made. I lower my voice. Guarding the orphan you created, patrolling the trade lanes you endangered. Maybe this is your chance, our chance, to put things back together. Not by hunting pirates out in the middle of nowhere, but by restoring order. You want to give them their evidence, their war? I do. He steps very close to me, so only I can hear. You open that safe, you're dead too. You won't have a chance to fix anything as soon as they find out who you really are. That's a chance I'm willing to take. Stop thinking with your cock. Serafina doesn't give half a shit about you. She's bait that Dido is dangling like a piece of meat. I snort. It's not about her, Cassius. No, it's about revenge, isn't it? Your revenge. You took yours, I say quietly. I watched him stand over my grandmother as she bled to death. I watched him kill Aja, the woman who was like a mother to me. You don't sleep. You drink. You preach and hunt pirates. We've never been in one place longer than a month. You think that is because you're protecting me? You think it's because you have a sacred duty to save merchants who chose to risk the belt to line their own pockets? Stop lying to yourself for one gory damn moment and admit that you made a mistake. You let the wolves through the door. Being a good man won't fix what you've done, neither will suspending yourself in a state of constant motion. There is no atonement except killing the wolves, shutting the door, and re-establishing order. That is how we make things better than they are now. It's how we can fix the worlds. Even though I know the intransigence of my friend, I hold out some boyish hope that my words will arouse some sense inside him. Instead, inexorably, his eyes harden. Our world darkens, and I know our fellowship has ended. I had you for 10 years. She had you for a breath. Is her spell so complete? I feel pity as I see him realize he has failed, not to protect me, but to convince me that he was right, that the pain he caused me was just. If he could convince me of all people, then perhaps he thought he would convince himself and know beyond all doubt that what he did was good. I've robbed him of that hope and any chance for his heart to be at peace. 10 years of brotherhood evaporate in a breath. We stare at one another and see strangers. He snaps his fingers at the guards. We're done here. They come forward and I step aside so they can lead him away down the stairs to his death. At the bottom of the steps he stops. This duel isn't for me, it's for you. If you love me at all, you will let me die. Beyond the black doors, down a narrow chasm of grey rock, lies the Bleeding Place. It is a circular amphitheatre carved into the stone of the mountain. Amongst sculpted lotus flowers, stone dragons, slick and pearly with condensation,
hang down from the dark ceiling as if to drink the blood centuries of Ra have spilled here to satisfy quarrels. Servants finish scraping yellow and green moss from a section of tiered benches carved into the rock. The benches encircle a white marble floor. At the centre of the floor, the sigil of gold has been emblazoned onto the pale stone. Hundreds of gold stand to watch from the stone as the brilliant son of Mars goes to meet their pale champion. Many are Ionian, but I see a Cordovan crest, a Norvo, a Felix, and scores more. A dozen moons are represented, and not just Jupiter's. I'm guided to a bench in the third row where the Ra family sit more than 30 strong, despite the gaps in their ranks from those imprisoned along with Romulus and the dust cells. The rim obeys the old customs. I look anywhere but at Cassius as a chance. A young girl of the white caste carrying a white bag leads a justice, an old blind woman with milky eyes and translucent hair, onto the fighting floor. One day the little girl will grow old, and if she reaches a state of transcendence, she will summon the courage to chemically blind herself and become a justice herself. It is the ultimate honour of this Hierophant race. Raised in monastic sanctuaries, they endeavour to divorce themselves from their humanity and embody the spirit of justice. Though many whites in my grandmother's society aspired to more worldly and profitable heights. The dualists bend to their knees as the frail Hierophant whispers blessings to them and touches her sacerdotal iron rod and laurel branch on each of their shoulders. Cassius stares at the floor, maybe still in that day on Mars with his father. When the justice has finished her benediction, she is led to her bone chair at the edge of the marble by white adjuncts. Chance pulls the string from the bag and litters white sand onto the floor until a large, unbroken circle is formed around the two men. I remember seeing the blood fill the white sand when I would go to the bleeding place as a boy to watch young peerless fillet one another over perceived slights. Seems just yesterday I saw Cassius, bold and young, cutting his way up through the duelists of Luna. I always thought the practice stupid, a vain exercise of pride. I'm numb to it now, replaying my conversation with Cassius over in my head, torn between honouring him and honouring my own conscience. Someone slides into the empty place on the stone next to me. I turn to see Seraphina. Her eyes surprise me with their sympathy. Is Cassius right? Would that sympathy vanish if the safe opened and she knew who I was? Would she let me die? Of course. Our ancestors have loathed one another for centuries. I'm sorry you must watch this, she says. If you were, you would have stopped it, I reply. It wasn't just me who saved your life, but of course, I assume you think gratitude a coward's conceit. I said I was sorry you must watch, not that he must die. He didn't kill your sister or your grandfather, no matter how absurdly you wish to twist it. He arrived after the massacre, and he was following orders from his sovereign. He partook, blood is on his hands, and so his will be on yours. I tire of looking at her. The slight imperfections, the heavy eyes, the sullen mouth, which I found so alluring, are now ugly and small. She stares on at me. The Reaper took your family when you were a boy, Bellona. Can you forget? Can you forgive? I remain silent because I don't know the answer. Dido watches Cassius on the floor from amongst her family. Farther down, ancient Gaia sits smoking her pipe, still playing the fool. And past her, separate from the family, Diomedes sits with a clutch of Olympic knights. They wear all black. Peerless steel glances at him, each with their own judgment of his honour for not being the one to challenge Cassius. He's the only Ra here who retains any of my respect. The knights alone have not taken a side in the coup, as ordered by Helios Aulox, arch-knight of their order. The Olympics sit in the gulf between a divided room. I discovered from eavesdropping that half of the powerful golds in here were called to Sungrave from their own mountain cities or moons before the coup began, under the false auspices of an emergency summons sent out by Dido under Romulus's warrant. They have been disarmed and held prisoner by Dido's men since they arrived. No armed obsidians or greys. Low colours are not allowed in this place. Duels are sacrosanct, propriety and manners imperative in the audience. We'll see how long that lasts. Dido stands and raises her hand for silence. Her allies quiet respectfully, but as an insult, her husband's allies speak on with one another and turn their backs to express their antipathy. It infuriates Dido. You know the face, her words are drowned out. You know the face of... Romulus's men speak even louder. At her side, Seraphina watches with faint amusement. Diomedes does not help his mother, nor does the arch-knight Helios. Bellerophon looks to Dido for instruction.
She flicks her hand for him to begin and sits down with her jaw set in anger. The knight slams his razor on the ground, once, twice, till the room is silent.
Cassius, our Bellona, I see you. Bellerophon stalks around the ring, his razor trailing behind.
You wretched buzzard, you spineless cur, you conspired to kill my grandfather in liege, you sought to kill my cousin in the flower of her life, you betrayed the compact of society and aided the slave king of Mars. You came here in disguise, intent on mischief, he smiles. For these insults you shall whimper and bleed.
Even Romulus's men are silent and stare down at Cassius. All know how he betrayed the sovereign, even if they did not claim her as their own.
Coincidence bringing Cassius into the rim beggars belief, so they require little to convince them that Darrow sent him here for some nefarious purpose. Cassius knows this, and so does Dido. Absent her evidence, she uses this to quell the dissent over her coup.
I came of my own accord, Cassius says to deaf ears. I have no affiliation with the Republic.
Bellerophon laughs.
Liar. Bring evidence if you think me a liar and try me. No? Then you have no evidence and you resort to blood feuds for justice. An absurdity in itself. But what can one expect from rim rustics? No one ever taught you manners. He chuckles. As for the blood feud, it I do not dispute.
The peerless meet the concession with hungry silence.
The blood of children and many more is on my hands. I expect no mercy. I ask only that if I fall, honour my bones and send them to the sun.
Bellerophon spits boorishly on the ground.
You will have no honour. Your corpse I will feed to my hounds so they might shit Bellona, but your eyes I will put in a jar so they might watch as I feed your brother to the dust.
Seraphina makes a disgusted sound. Amongst the Olympic knights and much of the room, the proclamation is met with sharp disapproval.
Helios makes a motion to Diomedes, who booms out an affirmation. You will be so honoured in your way, Bellona.
This maddens his cousin, and Bellerophon almost flies into the crowd to strike at Diomedes to finish their earlier affair.
I feel Dido's eyes on me, and I know Cassius was right, again. Of course, this is all for me. They think I am the weak link, that to spare Cassius's life, I will give them what Cassius will not.
Fools. They see my slender hands and naked face and believe me weak.
Dangerous game, judging a blade by its scabbard. I stay seated, silent, watching as Bellerophon shouts at chance and gestures to the bit of elm she holds in her hand.
Break the damn stick, girl, before I do it for you.
Startled, chance bends the elm, and as it snaps, the duel begins. The men do not lash into one another, but pace in a circle, measuring. Seldom have the forms of the core and the rim met in duels, at least after Derivus forbade any Ionians from dueling on Luna. Most of the rim houses followed his lead. As is old custom, neither duelist wears armour, though Cassius is allowed an aegis, a small shield generator embedded in a metal vambrace on the back of his left forearm. In his right hand he carries a coiled razor. They could have given him their unfamiliar, longer haster, but instead gave him a razor of the interior.
Bellerophon's haster slithers on the ground behind him like an oiled snake, nearly 3 meters long in whip and 2 meters in lance. In a scabbard on his left hip he carries the short Kitari thrusting sword. Hardening his razor into its lance form, Bellerophon raises the wicked black blade. Hands above his head, the weapon pointed toward Cassius so that Bellerophon looks like some strange, pale scorpion with its long stinger wagging in the air.
It is the shadowfall stance of the rim's razor masters.
He's a shade, I ask Seraphina.
She does not answer, her eyes devour the scene with excitement.
Cassius observes the alien stance warily. He holds his blade rigid and at his side with one hand in the summer hold of the willow way. His aegis he holds tight to his chest, ready to activate the shield.
I blink, and by the time my lid pulls back from my pupil, Bellerophon's blade has spun in his hands, changed to whip form, and now slashes at Cassius's face.
Cassius bends back, too slow. The whip slices a chunk of scalp off the front of his forehead.
Blood sheets down his face.
Bellerophon uses his momentum to spin with his whip forward, lashing it into another strike toward Cassius's leg. His attack relies on the length of the haster and his height to send the black blade falling down in a frenzy of incredibly swift blows.
It reminds me more of Darrow than Aja or Cassius. Blinking the blood out of his eyes, Cassius falls back under the onslaught, bending and circling and deflecting as the ground sparks from the metal whip.
His own whip is useless against the longer reach of Bellerophon's, so he uses it in rigid form for defence and relies on his aegis to turn away most blows.
Time and again he tries to close the distance, but while Cassius is stronger, Bellerophon is the quicker of the two, more accustomed to the gravity here. He shuffles his feet instead of lifting them. Each time Cassius attempts to close, Bellerophon slides back, calls his razor to rigid form, and nearly spears him through the stomach. The two men part, their world tiny and furious. Their bodies tell them to flee the metal and break out of the horrible confines of the circle, but their minds tether them together, and again they lash out. It has been years since Cassius has faced a man like this. I'm not sure he has ever faced Shadowfall in an actual duel. Each is a master of their craft, using their litany of tricks hard learned over the years, each probing, testing, then locking into a furious spate of exchanges, arms a blinding flurry, the whips nothing but blurred movement. Blood sprays across the white marble and into the stands where it spatters the face of a young child three rows back. I can't even tell which man is wounded until Cassius stumbles away, a flap of skin and muscle folding over a long laceration all the way to the bone of his left shoulder. Blood pours out. Bellerophon seizes the moment and presses his attack. "You can stop this," Dido says past Seraphina. "Give me the code and he lives." "He doesn't need my help." Despite my words, I watch in fear as Cassius falls back before Bellerophon and the momentum tips in the Rim Knight's favour. I thought Cassius invincible, part of a story that could never exist without him in it. They can't see the grandness of him. They can't see the warmth, the pain, the regret, the love. All they see is a vessel for their hate. They stare down at him pitilessly, thinking his death their right, even those adversaries who despise Dido's coup. In the circle, Cassius can barely see for the blood in his eyes. He has no time to wipe them clean. He's losing too much from his shoulder and now is pressed against the edge of the circle. His heels scrape the sand. Bellerophon lashes at him, maintaining his distance, but Cassius continues to turn away the whip with his aegis. The metal cracks into the small energy shield and bounces back, sending blue sparks hissing through the air as Cassius activates it milliseconds before each blow lands to prevent the shield from overheating. Smoke already rises from the battery pack. Bellerophon batters Cassius down, blow after blow, till Cassius is on a knee, the whip raining down on his smoking shield. Bellerophon's whip arcs in a high overhead strike. Cassius raises his arm yet again to deflect, but then his aegis winks out. The whip slashes down onto Cassius's raised left arm and coils tight around it. Bellerophon could rip off Cassius's arm from the elbow down, but he's caught in the middle of his acrobatics, expecting to meet the aegis again and for the whip to bounce back. He loses half a second. Now Cassius attacks. He uses the snapping branch gambit. Springing forward with his thick legs just as he jerks on the whip with his arm, he pulls Bellerophon off balance toward him. With his left hand, Bellerophon desperately brings his katari up to block Cassius, but Cassius bats the small blade to the side with his razor and then cuts diagonally at Bellerophon's right arm, which holds the haster. His diamond-hard blade cleaves through the bone of the man's arm like it's pudding. An open artery sprays a single spurt of blood 2 meters long. Cassius spins with his momentum and cuts in the other direction. The metal severs Bellerophon's remaining arm at the forearm. Both limbs spin to the floor. Bellerophon totters, looking at the weeping red stumps and the pale bone poking out from the meat, mouth opening and closing like a stunned dog's. I almost surge to my feet in a joyful shout as Cassius sets his hand on Bellerophon's shoulder and guides him gently to his knees. He looks up at Dido. "Prime show, my friend. Damn prime show." "Do not waste a man like this," Cassius says. "He bled for you. He doesn't have to die. Release me and mine, agree to our terms, and his life will be spared." Dido glowers down at him. Not for a moment does she entertain the idea of sparing her nephew. A cold heart beats in that chest. "Bellerophon," she asks, "your fate is yours."
"Pulvis et umbra sumus," he shivers. "Akari bear witness."
Honor calls him to the dark. What a waste of a man. But there is something beautiful in it all the same. His body shakes and I marvel at the life's worth of discipline that goes to keeping himself erect on his knees. The pale Ra knight looks to his family, his slender Norvo wife, and up to the dragons of his ancestors on the ceiling. Cassius hacks his head off at the spine. Beside me, anger roils from Seraphina as her cousin dies.
"This is your fault, my son," Dido says to Diomedes.
Amidst his knights, watching his cousin die in his stead, he looks stunned and stricken with guilt, almost as immense as my relief. Bleeding from his forehead and shoulder, drenched in sweat, Cassius manages to smile at me, knowing that I could have given in to Dido, but did not. He raises his chin and lifts his voice for all to hear.
I am Cassius Albalona, son of Tiberius, son of Julia, morning knight, and my honour remains.
It is over.
He has won. The matter is settled, though I don't know what shape the next moments will take, and then I look over at Seraphina, ready to console her on the loss of her cousin, only to see implacable Dido's face unchanged, her hand in the air, her fingers snapping together. Ferbera, she calls. My hope sinks and Cassius's face falls as a young, hawkish woman with a bald pate hefts her razor and jumps from the second row over the heads of those sitting on the benches beneath. She lands on the edge of the white marble and paces toward Cassius, her long razor rigid. She spits on the floor and enters the circle, where she crows her challenge to Cassius, her name and her right as cousin to open his veins.
It's over, I say in protest to Dido. The feud was settled with Bellerophon.
His feud is with the House of Ra, she replies.
There is a part of me that wants to rail against her and decry her hypocrisy, but the look she gives me is so reptilian that it activates the colder part of my own blood. The shock disappears, and I work to understand.
Do you support this? I ask Seraphina.
Though surprised at her mother's action, Seraphina says nothing.
Don't look to her, Dido snarls.
I preside here. That creature murdered my daughter. He killed Rivas.
The room cries for blood.
Then, very softly, Dido leans toward me.
But I can forget. I can forgive. And you can end this. Open the safe.
Dangerous woman. I look down at Cassius and let my silence answer. Dido sighs.
A pity. Ferbera, honour House Ra.
She is not a shade, but she is fast and knows this gravity. She lunges at him with her razor, roving and probing like she's hunting boar. Knowing he's losing too much blood, she tries to draw out the duel, but Cassius continues to charge in close. She's more agile than Bellerophon, but not so powerful. Cassius manages to pin her against the rim of the circle, where they exchange a dangerous series of slashing parries. She scores two cuts on his right leg, but has no time to save at the moment. I see her die 2 seconds before it happens. Cassius flows into the autumn wind movement as easily as if he were sparring together with blunted weapons on the Archi. He strikes 3 times at head level, locks blades, pushes against her so she counters his force, then he pivots right and slides his blade over top hers in a leverage position so the tip enters her forehead and pushes through her brain before coming out her throat and through her jaw. She dies before she hits the ground. He slides his blade from her skull, flicks off the grey gristle coating it, and limps to turn and face Dido. I am Cassius Albalona, son of Tiberius, son of Julia, morning knight, and my honour remains.
Dido snaps her fingers.
Bellagra. Another knight jumps down.
Seraphina, you're going to lose another cousin, I say, knowing that this execution wears on her.
Diomedes does not retain his composure. Mother, enough! Bellagra, honour House Ra.
The knight surges toward Cassius. This one was not the same quality as the first two and dies quicker than Ferbera. Cassius parries a weak blow and splits the man down the middle. His halves twitch on the floor and leak his life's blood into the gold sigil. But something strange has happened. Despite the condemnation of the Olympic knights, the room roils with volunteers. Each death decays their manners and resolve and reaches into the crowd with forked, root-like fingers to enrage and poison another soul. A lover there, a cousin, a friend, a drinking companion, a brother-in-arms. From Dido's allies to Romulus's, the anger boils. It dawns on me, then, the cruel stratagem the woman has devised. I don't doubt that her hatred of Cassius is real, but they do not waste in the rim. Each death is a down payment for her war. Absent her holodrop evidence, she uses my friends to boil the blood, to distract, to bind her allies and foes together in anger. And the more Ra that fall, the more her position solidifies, the more the blood of the rim is raised against the interior and not against her coup. This is the depth of her conviction, a willing sacrifice of her own kin to reveal whatever truth hides within our safe. I witness Dido at long last, the immensity of her resolve, the cruelness of her intellect, and I am terrified to think that I ever was so arrogant as to presume her Romulus is inferior simply because I'd heard his legend more. She reminds me of the woman who taught me all I know, more passionate, less subtle, but a shade of my grandmother dwells in this woman. At her side, Seraphina sits with a weary expression that seems to say she understands all but will suffer it because she must. But I cannot watch my brother suffer much longer. There will be no end to it. No mercy, just death, and for what? Cassius limps to his feet again, and standing over the body of his foe, The floor is littered with them. I am Cassius Albalona, he pants for breath, barely able to go on. Son of Tiberius, son of Julia, he squares his shoulders and summons his pride to lift his voice. Morning, night, and my honour remains. Mother, stop this madness, Diomedes cries out. He is one. How many of our blood will you throw away? As many as honour demands, she says. Save your kin, Diomedes. He does not rise. A pity, Dido replies. I feel the words coming before they leave her lips, because I saw Seraphina's legs bouncing, her fingers tightening the laces on her boots, and I saw Dido notice the glances shared between us at dinner. Now the woman turns to me, only one card left to play, and she plays it well. Seraphina, honour House Ra. Chapter 41. Lysander. Heart. Seraphina bolts upward like a coon released from its leash. She leaps, clearing the heads of those seated beneath us, and pulls free her razor before she lands on the killing floor. Diomedes watches in fear for his little sister, but the golds clamoring for their chance to face Cassius now sit back down in disappointed silence. They think the matter settled. Seraphina is the executioner. Cassius bleeds and sweats, his golden curls matted to his forehead, his knuckles sliced and savaged by metal. Blood soaks his shoes. His body is shaking from pain as steam trails off his flayed skin and open meat, but still he stands, using one of the discarded haster for a crutch, watching neutrally as tall Seraphina lopes into the circle. This is his end, but there's nothing glorious about it. All I feel now is dread. The same dread from that day when I watched my grandmother die and did nothing to stop it. Not even when I saw Cassius and the Reaper's pack finish Aja. I cannot hate him for his part. It was I who did nothing to protect those I love, and I do love him. In this moment, he is true and pure, and in a way, everything I wanted to be as a child. Tears, unwelcome and unfamiliar, leak out my eyes as Cassius looks at me and shakes his head. Let me die, he is saying. That is all he wants, absolution in death. But it is the wrong absolution, the wrong death. Seraphina steps past the corpses of her cousins and nods to Cassius. Bellona, would that we had met as equals. You deserve better. We all deserve the worms, Ra. Cassius replies. He wipes blood from his paling face. Shall we meet them together? In reply, Seraphina draws up into the shadow fall, a shade herself, and Cassius sinks into the willow way. Hoping to surprise her and knowing he can't last for long, Cassius lunges forward with his remaining strength. It is not enough. She ripples into motion. Not as fast as Darrow, not as strong as Aja, but smoother than either could ever hope to be, sliding sideways easy as a bird's shadow over the sea. She blocks his blade with her haster and spins her katari from her belt and hammers the blunted handle into his knuckles. Cassius's razor slips out of his hand and skitters over the bloody marble. He hunches without a weapon, panting. Sluggishly, he lunges for another discarded razor, but Seraphina cracks her whip and sends the weapon Cassius seeks flying into one of the walls. She stands over Cassius and allows him one last honour. My friend crawls to his knees, pauses there, gathering his breath, and with a groan manages to gain his feet. Dazed, he looks around the arena, lost until his eyes desperately find me. He gives me one last smile. One of thanks because he thinks that I have let him die for his cause. But I watched Aja die, I watched Grandmother die, and I did nothing but huddle in fear. I stayed silent and obeyed when Cassius said, follow, because I was afraid by crossing him I would lose him and be alone. Here at the end of the world, in the belly of a mountain surrounded by enemies, what is left to fear? I will not watch any longer. I launch myself from my seat, sailing in the low gravity over the heads of the golds beneath me, to land on the white stone of the killing floor just outside the circle. Seraphina turns around at the sound, stunned. I hold out my hands to the guards, showing I have no weapons. Don't, Cassius slurs. I won't let them kill you. Do not step into the circle, Seraphina growls. You have no right to this fight. His crimes are his alone. I turn to face Dido and the host of Ra. I have every right. I let the Martian drawl molt away from my voice like a tattered cloak to reveal my Hyperion heart beneath, and for a moment I feel proud to represent the City of Light here, so far from home. Luna may never have been perfect, may never have been as noble as I thought it was as a boy, but it gave peace for 700 years. I tire of apologizing for it, of being afraid of my own heritage. My days of running and hiding behind others are finished. I will no longer fear my name.
My name is Lysander Auloon, I bellow into the cold room. I did not know what weight my name still had, but the seismic tremors that now shake the room bring chills to my flesh and deep, powerful pride. Hate my grandmother all they like, the blood in my veins comes from Selenius the Lightbringer, greatest of our kind. It is the myth of my ancestors these people wrap themselves in. The first Ra elected Selenius sovereign. They bowed to him, as did all Ra thereafter until this generation. Seraphina almost drops her razor. Her jaw hangs open. Dido curses under her breath and leans back in her seat, unable to comprehend it. Diomedes stands, a look of childish awe on his grave face. Cassius watches in silence, his heart breaking in his chest. I am the blood of Selenius the Lightbringer, son of Anastasia, son of Brutus, grandson of Lorne our Arcus the Stoneside, and Octavia the Sovereign of Man. I was born upon the Palatine, west of Hyperion, at the heart of Luna and the City of Light. I may know little of the Rim, but even in the heart of Empire they spoke of the honour of House Ra, of the Moon Lords, chief among them the Ionian Golds. Where has it gone? Has it deserted you? Has it fled after the tremors of war? You may have lost it, forgotten it, but I have not forgotten mine, and my honour will not let me sit idly as this travesty unfolds. I feel Cassius's agony, but I cannot look at him. Your blood feud is sated by any measure. The Bellona have been wiped from the face of the world. Do not fall prey to the very cannibalism that allowed the rising to flourish. This man, this gold, is not your enemy. I am not your enemy. The Slave King is. I turn in a cold fury to Dido. Bring me the safe.
Chapter 42. Ephraim. Lucky you. We pull out of the rain onto the 50th floor of an abandoned building on the outskirts of a reconstruction zone. I turn off the music and look out through the windshield. Lights glare down from the level above. Exposed electrical lines and ventilation tubes snake through the building. In his chrome suit and black high-collared duster, Gorgo waits in a grand old dilapidated green armchair beside an industrial lift. Smoking burners. Purple smoke slithers in a halo around his gigantic head. Never thought I'd be happy to see him, I say to Volga, but I don't get out of the car.
Will they honour the contract? Volga asks.
I check the account. 25 million sits in the balance, put there when the operators confirmed we have the prize. We get the rest on delivery.
Don't know. You told the others they would?
No shit. What else would I say? I look back into the passenger compartment. The prizes are twitching under the plastic tarp. The anisine is wearing off. Hyperion is about to be thrown off its axis. The Syndicate is making a play. Can't even begin to guess what they want, but I wish I could see Lionheart's face when she finds out. She pardoned gold rapists, slavers, murderers. Now comes the bill for stabbing the rest of us in the back. And she'll find, as the rest of us have, that she can be touched by this war as well. I should feel driven by righteousness, but instead I feel dirty, sitting here with my human cargo. A man has to have a code. When did mine begin to include kidnapping children? They can't very well break their own rules, I say, trying to convince myself.
Are they broken if no one knows? Volga asks.
When did you become a philosopher?
I am wise. You are smart. This has always been our way. She sets a comforting hand on my shoulder.
You stay here, wise one. I can carry them myself. I get out of the car. Volga follows. I look at her as she looked back willfully. All right, together then.
Yes, together.
We haul the prizes out of the car. I lean in and lift the bag off Lyria's head, positioning myself so that Gorgo can't see her, hidden in the back. Remember, Rabbit, silence is golden. I set the bag back and leave her in the car. I let Volga carry both the prizes over her shoulders to Gorgo. He stands as we approach, eclipsing me by more than a foot and 100 kilos.
His black shark eyes drift back and forth between us and the prices.
Right on schedule. The Duke awaits.
He puts out his burner and motions for us to stop.
No weapons.
I put my pistol on the chair, and Volga sets her plasma rifle down. Gogo pats my arms, torso, balls, and legs with his huge hands. You enjoying that? I ask.
Wordless, he slides the stiletto out of my boot and takes four more knives out of Volga's jacket.
Really? I ask her. She shrugs.
Gogo finds two more knives in her boots and an acid shooter strapped to her calf. He stacks these with our other weapons and seems amused by the collection.
Little crow likes toys. Would you like to be one of mine? She ignores his predatory smile.
With the children in tow, we take a lonely lift up to the 52nd floor, where the Duke waits for us amongst a host of syndicate thorns. They stand in the shadows of the half-constructed high-rise, light from their burners catching on jewellery, platinum smiles and chrome job eye implants. At the far side of the floor, a sleek luxury yacht rests outside on one of the high-rise landing pads. The Duke applauds as we approach.
A debt was owed. A debt is paid.
He wears a jet-black asp skin jacket with long, calf-length tails. His lipstick is violet tonight, and he sits behind a plastic table with a steaming pile of half-eaten crab claws and two bottles of wine.
Punctual, well-dressed, and devastatingly handsome. My dear Ephraim, you are a treasure.
He eyes Volga.
You brought a bodyguard this time. How precocious of you.
She's luggage detail. The three obsidian men behind him stare at Volga. All are ice obsidian, probably ex-legion, and wear dusters and their bright white hair long and unbound. The biggest is a head taller than Volga and has emerald piercings in his chin. He grinds the haft of a chrome pulse axe into the concrete floor.
The prizes, as agreed upon, I say flatly. The nights exhausted me. Dano's death, robbing me of any humour. Volga hands over the prizes to two thorns, who lay them down on the table. The Duke pulls the hoods off the children's faces and coos to himself.
My, my, my. The Queen will be pleased. See, I told you, Gogo. He's pure quality. Syndicate material.
Gogo shrugs.
Gogo here did not think you were up to the task. He thought you would run. Fly to Earth, Mars. But no, I said. A man's reputation is his life's work. It is all he has. And you have lived up to yours. That Gravwell.
He shudders.
Patent Ephraim T. Horn.
He looks down at the children, focusing on Pax.
Hello, little prince.
He bends to inspect the boy more closely.
You may call me Dominus.
He rears back and slaps the boy across the face. Volga twitches. A red welt forms on Pax's cheek.
Weep.
He slaps him again. Weep. Pax stares on at him, trying to be brave.
Weep.
The Duke's voice loses the affected polish bit by bit till it sounds like an animal inside him is trying to escape.
Weep. Weep. Weep.
The sight of it disgusts me. But I stay rigidly still, afraid.
My Duke,
Gogo says. The Duke looks up at him, murder in his eyes. Gorgo stares back evenly but says nothing more.
The Duke slaps Pax again and tears finally leak out of the boy's eyes. The Duke shudders with pleasure and tucks back the pink locks of hair that have fallen over his eyes. He takes a teardrop on the tip of his finger and licks it off with his eyes closed.
Dates like justice.
His men laugh, Volga's trembling with anger. Poor girl looks like she's going to lurch forward and strangle the man. I shake my head at her, but her eyes are fixed on the Duke. The man's voice softens to a coo as he bends to stroke Pax's face.
There, there, little prince. Do not weep. Shh. Consider me an ambassador, welcoming you to the real world. The rest of us have been here for some time. But do not worry. You'll soon learn the rules.
He turns to his thorns. Put them in my yacht. No rough play.
We mustn't damage the queen's merchandise. She has quite a plan for them.
The men haul the children up and take them away. Volga's eyes follow them till they disappear into the ship.
Apologies, he says, the polish back. At the root, I am a creature of severe passion.
I expect the rest of my payment now, I say, eyeing the thorns behind me. They've crept closer. My voice sounds dead even to my ears.
Yes, yes.
He makes a dismissive gesture to a thorn. My data pad vibrates as the funds transfer. Thank you, I say, checking the number. It's been a pleasure doing business.
That's it?
The Duke asks, raising his plucked eyebrows.
Am I a payday so summarily dismissed? I thought our fraternity ran deeper. I even saved you a bottle of La Dame Chanceuse. I was hoping we could drink it together.
Now?
Yes, now. A toast to a success for the ages. A triumph for the little men.
It's been a long night. I'm not thirsty.
My darling Ephraim, where did the rogue go? Where is the bluster? The charisma. Dirty deeds deserve sweet reward.
His fingers run along the edge of the bottle.
If I didn't know better, I'd think your scruples were rankled.
You hired a professional, I say. If you want a social companion, I suggest you call up some pink entertainment. I hear they're splendid company. His smile disappears. Thank you again for your time, my good Duke. I turn to leave. Volga doesn't turn with me.
What will you do with the children?
She asks. No, no, no. I turn back around. The Duke's eyebrows float upward.
It speaks.
But she's passionate too, I say. Means nothing by it. Come on, Volga.
Not at all, the Duke beams. It's a fair question for the curious crow after all the sweat and ill deeds. What if I told you I was going to give them to the big brutes behind me to play with, as I was played with my entire life?
The Duke asks.
What would you do?
Volga doesn't answer.
What if I said I was planning to feed them to ants? What response would that elicit? Violence, perhaps?
He smiles.
Yes, I think so. Morality is a dangerous thing for a thief to possess in company such as this.
I pull Volga's arm. Would be easier to tug on a house. I'm about to say something when a pipe clanks behind us near the stairs beside the elevators. The thorns wheel around with their weapons as a bolt of red hair disappears down a stairwell. The Duke snaps his fingers and his obsidians are loosed.
their long legs covering the distance in two breaths, and they fly down the stairs. My blood runs cold. You stupid girl. Gorgo blocks our path to the elevators.
Did you bring company? The Duke asks me.
No. Are you certain? There are motion detectors on all the entrances. Your flyer was the only one allowed in. Who did you bring with you?
No one. My crew's gone to ground.
Sit. I'm about to object, but Gorgo shoves me into the chair in front of the table. Two obsidians wrestle Volga down. One shoves an industrial laser cutter in front of her face. The red beam wavers close to her eyes. She goes still. In the distance, we hear the muffled sounds of scorchers going off. I feel myself darkening. I let a rabbit into the wolf den. Now they tear her apart. The Duke waits, staring at me, a single vein pulsing under his right temple, until one of his obsidians returns. I hold my breath at the sound of boots approaching. When the man finally comes to the Duke's table, I can breathe. Miraculously, he's empty-handed.
It was a ruster, he rumbles. She escaped.
The Duke stares at him.
A red? Escaped? You, Belloc?
We had her cornered. She dove into a ventilation shaft. She's likely pulp.
A ventilation shaft?
We could not fit. It led down. Harald and Hjefjord hunt. They will bring her head back by its bone tail. The Duke continues to stare at the brute until the obsidian lowers his eyes in fear. He glances plaintively to the other obsidians, but there's no pity in their arctic eyes.
I am disappointed in you, Belloc.
Yes, Lord.
Do you know what the Queen would do if she were disappointed?
The obsidian glances at Gorgo, who's bearing his crescent of gold teeth.
Yes, Lord.
Fortunately, I know how difficult it is for a bear to catch a mouse. So many holes for them to run to. So I will forgive you. But I fear a debt is now owed. How will you pay?
The obsidian looks forlorn. Slowly he extends his left hand. The Duke slaps it lightly.
The left. Very good. How old was the girl?
Young. 20 winters.
Distinguishing features?
She wore a tuxedo.
A tuxedo?
The Duke looks at me, then back at the obsidian.
Go help your brothers, Belloc.
The obsidian bows and rushes back to the stairs, disappearing into the shadows. The Duke returns to Gorgo.
Wake the Baron of this neighborhood. Kreminsky, isn't it?
Gorgo nods.
Put out a bounty on a red bitch wearing...
He looks at me again.
A tuxedo.
Gorgo steps away. The Duke looks back at me, tapping his lacquered nails on the table.
I am also disappointed in you, Ephraim.
She's not... One of the obsidians slaps my right ear. But a slap from one of them is like getting a door slammed on your head. I pitch sideways to the ground for the second time of the night. They straighten me back in the chair.
Who was she?
The Duke asks. I don't know.
Are you lying to me? I do hate liars.
Why the bleeding hell would I bring someone else here? I shake my head so I can see straight. I know the rules.
Yet you broke them. I said only bring your team, and you didn't even bring all of them.
as if you were afraid of me, as if I wouldn't keep my word, as if I need to lie. I never bring my team to a drop. He looks at Volga in amusement. Except your luggage hauler. But do not fret. Since you took it upon yourself to disobey me, I took it upon myself to help you follow the rules.
Gorgo returns from his call, dragging a woman behind him. It's Sira. They've brutalized her. Face, one large contusion. Volga lunges forward. An obsidian slams Volga in the back of her head with a haft of one of their axes. She goes woozy and tries to get up. He and another thorn kick her legs out and stand on her back so she's belly down on the floor.
Volga, stop, I tell her numbly.
The Duke watches me with neutral expression. Is this how the Syndicate treats its contractors? I say.
No, I am no slaver. Respect is given until a debt is owed. The Duke smiles. After all, what is a man without a code?
Sira looks up at me helplessly through the swollen mess of her face. I never liked her. Not that I liked Dano that much more, but it makes me sick what these psychos have done to her. Let her go. She's done nothing to you.
On the contrary, she has betrayed a friend of mine.
Who?
His eyes glitter. You, darling.
What? What are you talking about?
Your friends are cheap, Gorgo says. I approached the red man, but this one, she came to me of her own volition, offering to spy on you for money. Every smoke, every drink, she scurried to me and chittered in my ear like a little greedy pet wanting a snack and a pat on the head. Wants to be a thorn, this one.
Sira can't meet my eyes, and I feel sick, knowing it's true.
You were a friend? Volga says to her.
No, she wasn't.
I assume the red girl you brought from the ship was your insider, the Duke asks. Lyria of Lagalos? The one who fooled into carrying Kobachi's drone?
I never wanted the Syndicate to know about Lyria. Sira did tell them everything.
Yes. And then you saved her life. Your professionalism is suddenly quite indicted, Ephraim.
There's no smile on his face now.
Why save her?
You asked me if I was a thief of order or one of chaos, I say slowly.
I get the groove. This is your world now. Your rules. She performed a service. A debt was owed. She deserves to get paid. That is a good answer, the Duke says. But she is not a thief. And she is not your friend. She is a slave in all but name, and will run back to her masters. So, I am afraid she must die.
He waits for me to object, but I know it's useless. The only thing I can protect now is my life and Volga's.
I suggest we kill him too,
Gorgo says.
Oh, my! Are you now the Duke of Hands, Gorgo?
The Duke asks.
No? Then shut your mouth.
Gorgo smiles coldly at him, but says nothing.
You have complicated things, Ephraim. But the Syndicate honors its contracts. You owe nothing. You are free to leave.
What about her? I ask, looking to Sira.
She has shown a duplicitous nature. She cannot be trusted. If she spoke so quickly to us, who else might she speak to? But she wronged you, not me. Therefore, her fate is in your hands. Acid, axe, fire, feast, choose the one-way ticket. Ephraim, I'm sorry, she says pathetically through swollen lips. I can't hate her. I'm too tired to hate her. Please. Volga, I ask. She shakes her head. Just let her go, I say to the Duke. Thank you, Sira whimpers. Thank you. Volga, I... Don't talk to her, I snap. The Duke raises an eyebrow. Very well. Gogo, you heard the man. Let her go. Gogo grabs Sira by the hair and drags her to the edge of the high-rise. She kicks and screams when she sees what he's about to do. Ephraim! Ephraim! I do nothing. Gogo throws her off the edge of the high-rise like a sack of trash. We don't even hear the impact. I imagine her lying in a messy pile of meat 50 stories below, like Trig on that mountainside. I watch the Duke, my ears filled with the scream of memory. Let the obsidian girl up, the Duke says. Released by the thorns, Volga stumbles to her feet, more angry than afraid. Only that one was loyal in the end. I appreciate loyalty. So her life is my parting gift to you. A proven, true friend. You are lucky. Such is more than most thieves can manage. I face the Duke and swallow back the bile. Then I thank you for your patronage, Duke. I trust our business is concluded. For today, I turn and help Volga limp away. Ephraim, the Duke calls. I pause, fearing another twist. I wonder, where will you go now? To sleep. Alone? A pity. But after that? Don't know. Haven't thought that far ahead. You have money now, all for yourself. Money enough to retire, to do whatever you like. But I know you, and you are not the sort to gather dust. You need this life, need it to feel alive, to feel anything at all. We always want more, people like you and me. The Queen can give you what you crave. I can give that to you. I spare a look at Gorgo, then ask the Duke, are you offering me employment? The Duke smiles. Amongst other things. He gives a card to Gorgo, who brings it to me. A datapad number is printed in white on black. When you grow bored, I'm always looking for a helping hand. Gorgo holds on to the card with his long nails as I try to pull it from him. The card tears in half. He flicks his end at my face. I gather up the pieces and put them into my pocket, and Volga and I walk away, doing everything in our power not to run as fast as we can. In the back of my mind, I wish Rabbit a swifter end than Sira's. Rat or not, the green was one of mine, and now a debt is damn well owed.
Chapter 43, Lyria, Street Prey. My shoes pound wet pavement. The sound of scorchers echoes in my ears. The weapons chewed the ground around my feet as the obsidians rushed me in the industrial tower. Scarier than the bloody damn red hand. There were three of them in black, their hair white as bleached bone. They moved faster than the dogs of Camp 121, pushing off walls and support beams like there was no gravity. I thought I was dead, cornered on a level with only open air behind me. I saw an open ventilation duct. Didn't even look to see if it had a bottom before I dove in. The sheet metal vaporized behind me from their weapons. I fell 10 levels before I managed to jam out my legs and hands to halt my fall. The friction shredded the skin from my palms and dislocated my shoulder. But I managed to slide down the rest of the way, just as my brother Angus taught me in the vents of Lagolos. For the first time in my life, I'm glad I'm small. When I reached the end of the air duct, I kicked my way out, found a construction ladder down, and then limped off into the streets of the reconstruction zone. Still, the obsidians follow. I can't outrun them, so I jump into a dumpster behind a tenement complex and push rotting trash over myself. Rats the size of toddlers and cockroaches the size rats should be scurry around me, biting my back, my arms. But I lay corpse still and listen to the obsidians howling to each other in their alien tongue. They're searching the streets. A searing line of pain works its way down my left forearm. I must have cracked the bone in the fall. Someone's coming. I hold my breath. The top layer of skin on my hands oozes blood. I wince as I clutch the shiny pistol I took from outside Philippe's car. I was too terrified to turn around and use it on the obsidians. I've never even held a weapon before. Could I shoot a man? Who were they, anyway? Who did Philippe deliver the children to? The pink one was the boss, but I didn't hear his name. If only I'd caught Philippe's... his real name. I hate the bastard. His crow shot Kavix. They killed Kavix. Are they going to kill Pax and the girl? Don't let them die. Don't let it be my fault, please. I shift in the garbage. Flies buzz up in my face. The smell brings me back to the dump site outside 121. I feel Liam pressed against my chest, his little heart beating so fast. Oh, it's too much. I fling myself out of the garbage bin, swatting the flies off me in a panic. My shoulder stabs with pain. I kneel there in the street amongst burner butts and feel the tightness in my chest fade as the rain soaks through my tuxedo jacket. Think, Lyria, think. I have to run. But where do I go? The Sovereign will think I'm in on this, and they'll kill me or put me in a cell for the rest of my life. I can't go back to the Citadel. But Liam... Only shadows populate the streets. Cold rain has been falling since we left Quicksilver's. My teeth chatter together. I think of Kavix's kind face, how he said that Sophocles chose me. How I was a sign of magic. Bloody damn lie. I'm poison. All the time I was in the Citadel, I resented them. I loathed the Sovereign. That's why the children were taken, because I was rotten. I was stupid enough to trust a grey. I tuck Philippe's pistol inside my jacket. Pick a direction and start moving, sticking to the shadows. I jog as much as I can, but my shoulder hurts so bad I have to rest every 3 blocks or so. I reach into my jacket to clutch the pistol and duck into a doorway when several hover bikes roar down the street. On the backs, men in shiny beetle black helmets scan the shadows. I fall to the ground and start shaking like an addict and scratch under my nose like I've just done black dust. One of the hover bikers pauses 10 meters away, then rips off down the street, thinking me a junkie. I can't linger here. They'll flush me like they did in the dump at 121. I gotta go up. Carefully, I leave the shadows and push on, searching for a lift. but all the tenement houses here are stunted buildings underneath the foundation lattice that supports the high-rises. Those that are connected to the high-rises are fortified and secured with huge doors. I pound on several, but they won't let me in. So I follow old elevated tram tracks looking for a station. Might be a lift near one. Up ahead, I hear a nostalgic sound through the rain. A zither. Reds. They might help me. Underneath the tram is an abandoned derelict station skinned in graffiti. A tent city of vagrants has sprouted up around it. Electronics glow from inside the tents, and men gather around a burning barrel for warmth.
"Oi, what have we got here?"
a man asks, spotting me.
"You lost, little lass."
He's from Mars by the sound of him, and I know right off I've made a mistake. "Lo, brother, there a lift near here?" I ask. "I'd settle for stairs."
"What would a little thing like you need to go up for?" another red asks, this one from Mars too. "You'd look better going down."
I step back from him. "Some nice silk that," another says.
"Fancy silk. Gamma silk."
"Righto, have we got a gamma on our hands, lass? Teeth all clean, hair all nice.
What's your name, lass? Where you from?"
"None of your bloody damn business," I say. "But if you want to point me on my way, might be some chit in it for you."
"Might be we just take that chit." "Why are you holding your arm?" one of them asks. "You fall from the sky. Aerial accident."
His teeth are black and crumbling from demon dust. He's got the black tip on his nose, the cartilage eroding between the two nostrils.
"Come here, let's take a look at it."
Two of the men on the outskirts of the group have started inching toward me from the sides. I back away. My shaking hand drifts into my jacket. "You want to mind yourself," I say thinly. "My people will be looking for me."
"We're your people, lass."
Memories of red hands in the moonlight seep into the moment. "Come on and get warm by the fire.
We got some swill and some dust if you want to see angels, sister. We'll show you that. All the sights of the veil."
"You warm each other up," I snarl. "Touch me and I'll burn your bloody balls off."
"Nah, nah, moody one," the one with the teeth says.
He's been slowly walking toward me.
"That's not what a lass's mouth is for, don't you know?"
I pull the pistol out of my jacket and point it at his balls. The men recoil, but the one with the black teeth just laughs at the trembling barrel.
"Nice scorcher, da. Classic lions. Where'd you get your hands on a piece like that? Master, give it to ya."
As he waits for an answer, his eyes flick up. It saves my life. I wheel around and see a man lunging toward me from behind. I fall back and pull the trigger. The gun is silent and without recoil. His leg explodes as the metal slug tears into it. The skin of his thigh peels back like the flesh of an overripe peach. His severed leg kicks back across the pavement, hissing steam and blood. He screams, looking at the stump, and falls. I wheel on the rest of them with the gun. They cower like children. I step toward them, heart raging, wanting to kill every last piece of shit. The man on the ground moans in pain, clutching his mangled stump, and I feel sick. I turn and run from them till my legs are numb. Shaking, I collapse between two crumbling tenement complexes. Dogs bark and babies scream out open windows. My stomach lurches and I sick up all over the trash. When my stomach has emptied, I fall back on my ass and shake. The man is going to die. I was going to kill the rest of them. I tossed the gun away, disgusted. There's a loud roar and the sound of a crash from the street. I crawl to peer out of the alley and see a street stained by the green sign of a tenement complex. A hover bike idles in the centre of the street. A huge man gets off the back and pulls off his helmet. White hair flows down his back. He can't be more than 20, though it's hard to tell with obsidians. The man stalks toward a person he just shot through the leg with the harpoon reel from the front of his bike. Faces watch out the windows of the complex. The obsidian picks the person up with one hand and draws a pointed hammer from a holster on his back. I look away and almost throw up again when I hear the wet sound of the skull caving in. The faces disappear from the windows and the bike roars away, dragging the red-haired body behind on the harpoon reel. I pick the gun back up. If I stay on the streets, they'll find me. I look up and see the rails of the old tramway. If I can climb up there, I can move without being on the streets. But someone might see me. I gotta risk it. My fingers are bloody by the time I climb the cracked concrete support column up to the tramline. There's a depression between the rusted rails that I can scramble along without being seen from the ground. It's all that saves my life. As I work my way along the tramline, more bikes search the streets. Like the whole underbelly of Lost City has woken to try and find me. Who are these people? Over the next hour, I pass several public grav lifts, but they're all guarded by men in black coats with chrome nightshades. Finally, exhausted and shivering, I find an abandoned stairwell beside a derelict grav lift. It's unguarded. Feral dogs snarl at me, their eyes glowing from under the covered stairwells, as I make my way upward toward the lights of Hyperion 90 levels above. As I ascend level by level to brighter, more reputable zones of the city, flyers speed through the air in the avenues, surface cars and trams rattle on the crisscrossing bridges. I duck my head when I feel eyes on me and keep a white-knuckled hold on the pistol inside my jacket. Now that I have it, I don't ever want to be without it again. I stop glancing up at the smog layer above. It seems no closer each time I do. This city wasn't meant to be crossed on foot. But there's no one to ask for help, and even if I did find watchmen down here, I'd be too frightened to approach them. Not after last time. Who would believe my story? And who's to say they aren't on the payroll of the man Philippe works for? Remembering that pink smile chills me as much as the rain. Slick, pretty, but rotten underneath. Just like the rest of this forsaken city. I'd do anything to be home. Not in the citadel, not in the camp, but in the mine. My family around me before the world started chewing us one by one. Ava, why did we ever leave? I speak to her as if she had the answers. But it only raises more doubt. In the citadel there's a pair of other mothers desperate to find their children. Children I lost. My legs burn, each step harder than the last. It seems a life ago when I thought this gravity easy, back when Philippe and I walked the whole promenade. Was all of it a lie? Even the pain I saw in him. I make it to the next level. Then the next one after that. It's anger keeps my ass moving. Anger at Philippe for using me. At the men who thought I was their prey, at myself for trusting anyone on this bloody damn moon. I'm almost there. The stairwell grows cleaner. The graffiti is covered up by grey paint. There's more lights, more cars. More sounds of a healthy city, sirens and advertisements. The stray dogs are on their lonesome now and wag their tails at me as I pass. I'm just beneath the smog. I can see the neon stain of hollow advertisements through the grey clouds, and a checkpoint up guarding the entrance to the promenade levels above the smog. If I keep going up, I'll have to pass through it. I could stay a level below. There's shops, lights, people milling through the streets. I look out at the city in the rain, my breath clouds in front of me. I could disappear. I could find a way to run. But if I do, then what of it? I'm like Philippe, just another canker. I'd never see Liam again. As the rain seeps through my saturated tuxedo, I keep coming back to my sister's face the moment we parted in 121. The fear in her eyes, the trust when she begged me to protect her son. It shatters all that's left of me to know I did that to someone else. Helped a man steal their children. Watch the man who brought me out of hell die on the floor. I lean against the concrete barrier to catch my breath. The sounds of the city warble all around me, but I feel so very far away. I hear the laughter of my nieces and nephews. I remember the smile on my father's face when he'd find me wearing his boots. I ache for my mother, who deserved so much more than to wither and die from the inside. I miss my brothers who went off to war, and I see again my sister perched up on that rusty antenna looking out over the camp and dreaming of stars she would never reach. And I feel anger, a consuming, furious anger building in my chest at the people who would destroy families, hunt their fellow humans. The sovereign didn't protect my family. But I'm not her. I force my legs to climb the last stairs to the first promenade level and walk toward the fenced checkpoint. I swallow my fear of the greys behind the duroglass. My hands rest atop my head as best they can with my injured shoulder. A weapon warning siren warbles as a scanner flickers blue light over my body. Weapon detected, weapon detected, weapon detected. Two watchmen atop the guard posts aim their rifles at me. Stop, citizen, a voice says over a speaker. On your knees or we will shoot.